All right, this is Sierra Dahl of Municipal Sustainable Energy Forum, and today's discussion is centered around environmental justice. So we'll start out with Benny Hayden, from the founder of Marketing for Green out of Atlanta, Georgia. And we'll follow that up with Michael Fladmark from Trinity Community Solar Systems in Texas, and also Michael Walton from Green Spaces Chattanooga in Tennessee. So go ahead, Benny.
All right, thank you, Sierra. Hello, everyone. Glad to be with you today. And yes, I do currently live in Atlanta, but I also want to point out I'm a transplant Detroiter in Atlanta. So it's important to me to give that the Detroit cred out there. But again, this is a excellent topic. I think it's a really hot topic given the new administration. And opportunities or projects related to low-income housing, one of the first things I do is ask myself, why is this area, you know, low income to begin with? Just to give you a little bit of historical perspective, as relates to African-American communities, there is a history of wealth creation that goes back to, say, for example, you know, like Black Wall Street, which was in Tulsa, the Negro Leagues, the Negro Baseball Leagues were an excellent economic development engine, you know, historically Black colleges, HBCUs, and just basic entrepreneurship. So the question I would ask myself is, how did this community transition from a history of ownership, what I refer to as consumerism? And just some other background information, you think of some of the challenges right now in urban areas and low income communities, the dollar only turns like maybe one time, you know, so compared to say other ethnic groups, you may see the dollar may recycle up to 7 or 8 times. So that's why I tend to look at solar as a way, as a vehicle for economic development in the community itself, so that community can become some semblance of being self-sufficient, if you will. And my work in this area included a project with the Department of Energy. Some of you may be familiar with this project. It was referred to as the Solar in Your Communities Challenge, which a 2-year project started in 2017, ran through 2019. And basically, you know, we deployed over 175 solar projects that targeted low-income communities. And one of the really cool things of one of the projects that I specifically got a chance to work on, you know, as a project coach, and it speaks to this notion of economic development, was a public-private partnership in the city of Baltimore. If there's anything I want you to take away from my discussion with you today, it's the importance of outreach as relates to working in low-income areas, okay? And this particular project in Baltimore was a private-public partnership between Under Armour, the apparel manufacturer, the local utility, Power 52, the local solar company, which is owned by Ray Lewis, the former professional football player. And we was able to provide solar, we were able to help reduce the electric bills of over 800 residents in the area of Cherry Hill in Baltimore. The other significant part about this project was we had a workforce development, were able to provide certification for individuals who had criminal backgrounds. You know, these were over 85 individuals who had criminal backgrounds, and they received certification as a solar installers, and they were actually placed in jobs. And so my experience has been that one of the things I've learned in working with this particular population, you know, that being folks who have some type of criminal background, they generally have really good attendance rates, higher than the general population once they get a job. And so that's one thing I would say, keep in the back of your mind. And that was really one of the cool things, because about that particular project is that we're able to have some type of social impact and was able to provide some sort of economic development in terms of job creation for those local residents. And along one of the things I want to mention, I'll be sending to Sierra a list of resources to share with you guys. And one of those resources is the case study that was developed as a result of this Solar in Your Communities Challenge. And the case study is really intended as a resource for municipalities But as a developer, as a consultant, it would save you a bunch of time and money, because what we did is we took 10 projects out of that 175 that I referred to, and these projects can be replicated, and it will give you ideas for financing, and also give you ideas as relates to what type of barriers you may be able to anticipate by working in this segment of the market. And the other thing I would share with you with as it relates to segmenting the market, think about segmenting the market in terms of seniors. There is a push to help seniors who say have that is obviously, you know, powered by electricity in the era of a power outage. This becomes a life or death issue. So that would be one way I would approach it. And one of the things that we're also doing now is in terms of going back to this wealth creation, I'm actually involved with a group that we're trying to jumpstart clean tech manufacturing, affiliated with HBCUs or HBCUs research. But we're looking to locate these manufacturing centers in areas of low income and employ low income people for these jobs. Okie doke. So the second thing I want to talk to you about, if we're going to pivot, is the other area I've worked into is this notion of corporate authenticity as relates to sustainability. And because when you think about sustainability, it was always intended as three things: people, planet, and profits. And what I learned early on in my career when I used to call on, you know, corporate sustainability managers, the part about environmental and so forth, but they tend to shy away from the social part or the people component. And I would get like, you know, excuses like, well, we don't want to get too far out there. And a really good example is how I attended a workshop, a corporate workshop, which included over, most of these guys there were from Fortune 500 companies. And over the course of 2 days, 12 presentations, only one guy who happened to be the last guy, he said sustainability, corporate sustainability is all three: people, planet, and profits. And so what I find is that corporations, in terms of authenticity, they tend to, when it comes to social impact, they tend to stick to what I refer to as generic, you know, generic things like philanthropy, charitable giving, and employee volunteering, which they view as safe. Again, not trying to take a swipe at that, but I'm just simply saying they're missing opportunities if they were to have if they were to think about maybe having a process. And that's the other thing I learned is that because of the lack of diversity, you know, the lack of training and the lack of leadership, I would estimate only 10% of corporations really get sustainability as it's intended to be, you know, implemented. Again, the three different tenets. So what I think the solution is to address this, I think corporations obviously have to become more diversity, have more diversity of thought. You know, my definition of diversity doesn't necessarily have to be based on race or gender, but it can just be based on diversity of thought. You know, corporations also need, in my mind, a process in terms of how to identify opportunities for social impact, because you will find that most of them do not. And that the process should be based upon, you know, what is the corporation's value chain, right? And a really good example of this is when Whole Foods decided to locate in the city of Detroit. A lot of people thought they were crazy for doing that, because we think about Whole Foods model, you know, that being in college towns and whatnot. But one thing that the CEO did that I really was impressed with, he reached out to, you know, a couple of African-American nonprofit directors who manage urban farms. And he actually just simply said, hey man, teach me how to market to urban consumers. You know, just something that's simple, but it shows you the amount of humility. And that Whole Foods market is doing very, very well in the city of Detroit. So these are the type of things, again, I think the corporations need to think about as we move forward. And hopefully now, you know, with, you know, some, we do see some encouragement, but we still have a long way to go. And so I hope that this information I've shared with you today has been helpful. And I hope that you take a look at these resources that I will be sharing with Sierra. And I want to thank Sierra for giving me this time to share my two cents with you today. Thank you.
It's all very important. Actually, can you all hear me? I tried muting myself. I'm not sure if I succeeded at unmuting. Everybody hear me? Okay. All right. Good. Okay. Michael Fladmark, you want to go ahead?
Sure. First of all, welcome everyone, and thank you for the opportunity to representing Texas in regards to both environmental and energy poverty issues. I have a fellow founder and member of the board with Trinity Community Solar, and we're a brand new startup nonprofit that's focused on trying to bring energy parity to low-income communities. And we want to try to do that with community solar and working within the North Texas region. And our pushback is that we're in a deregulated market. And so there's really no models to help us to encourage the delivery of renewable energy and aspects to the low-income communities without, one, improving infrastructure, and two, getting buy-in from the distribution companies as well as the state legislatures and the municipalities and things like that. So we have a slightly different ball game here in Texas. But what I did do, I provided a link of resources. I was thinking of pulling it up, but I think I won't do that because Sierra has already sent it out to everyone. And what it is it shows a list of players that have been active in this area for energy equity in low-income communities, both in the Dallas region, in Texas, and then nationally as well. And so I just kind of wanted to highlight some of those. And so in the city of Dallas, just last year, over a couple year initiative that had a lot of outreach and communication with the city of Dallas, very important, they published and was adopted by the City Council of Dallas, their climate energy initiative for the next to 2030 and to 2050. And incorporated within that document, and I provided the link to there and the two primary contacts, is they have a large focus on energy poverty. And part of that also deals with transportation issues as far as the impacts on low-income communities, because one, the two major things besides rent that low-income communities have to deal with is one, is how do they pay for their power and how do they get to their job? And so, those are all challenges and they all have to be brought to the table and discussed. So, our focus being, trying to bring energy to them, they're also dealing with these other issues as well, as far as how do they actually pay for it? So another group that's involved with that, of course, is our regional council of government called the North Central Texas Council of Governments. And they're very interactive with the entire region, very proactive in regards to both energy, transportation issues is one of their major keys because the city of Dallas has lost its, they're always under the EPA eye because of their air pollution, and it's primarily from transportation. Because everyone's driving. So they're trying to expand and focus on mass transit issues and how to reduce those impacts. They have another program that's incorporated within there. The acronym is RISE, and is trying to just get innovative programs within the municipalities within the region and primarily focused on solar. I also sit on a board and a member of the North Texas Renewable Energy Group, which is the Dallas sister organization for ACES, Texas, which is the Texas organization for solar from the American Solar Energy Society, which is all of them linked and all of them have focused on programs on energy poverty and working with, organizations that are focused on trying to get involved with dealing with these problems and issues. I also provided a link to some other organizations that you may be aware of, but they're organizations that are not necessarily always thought about energy. One is the Climate Reality Project. It is, but at the same time, they have their initiatives about climate change, right? And then the Citizens Climate Lobby is another one that they're active in the North Texas region focused on. So there's always discussions leading to low-income communities. the Dallas Innovation Alliance, as well as a group, Green Careers Dallas. I'm a founder and a board member of that group that is focused on workforce development and solar in the low-income community to get them into the solar industry, first as installers on the rooftop, and then hopefully they can move from there. We also work with returning citizens community as well to get them certified, to get them OSHA 10-hour and everything like that. So please, I know my time is up on this, but there's a lot of activity going on. There's a lot of moving parts to try to get things going, but has it really been truly addressed and solved? No. I mean, truly addressed is the wrong wording, but trying to make it happen is a work in progress. So right. I'll leave it to that and turn it over.
All right, Michael, that green space is Chattanooga. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. I'm gonna share my screen here real quick. And so some of this is gonna be a little bit of overlap in terms of what you just heard. Benny talked about the triple bottom line, and that is exactly what we talk about at Green Spaces. So we help people take practical, effective, and affordable steps to improving their environmental, economic, and social outcomes. That is what we're about. And so we help businesses do that with our Green Light Business Certification. We help buildings do that with our net zero energy homes and our Build a Green Leadership and Workforce Development Program, also very similar to what Benny talked about. and we help people do that at home through our Empower Outreach and Workshops, home energy upgrades, and in-home asthma prevention program. And then also in the community and at school with our Chattanooga Green Pre our integrated community sustainability plan. But what we're going to talk about today is environmental justice and how that fits into our work in low-income housing. Chattanooga and Tennessee in general has this really strange predicament with energy. So we have some of the cheapest electricity prices in the entire country, and simultaneously have some of the highest average bills in the entire country. Now, how is that physically possible? How can you pay the lowest rate and still pay the most? The answer is the quality of our built environment. And so that's what these maps really show. The quality of the built environment in Tennessee, especially in low-income households, has a massive amount of opportunity for energy savings. And that's not equally spread across the community. It's not that everything's built that poorly. If we look here on the left, this is a map of energy use intensity when we started our Empower program, where we looked at the entire county and looked at energy consumption per square foot of home, and then aggregated that up to a 1 square mile grid. And so these areas stand out as being having more homes that have higher electric bills. The map on the right is a map of calls to our emergency 211 hotline for emergency utility assistance. So people have received a cutoff notice, their electric is about to get turned off, and they need help now to pay that bill, or else they're gonna be without electricity. And so again, that's not evenly spread. That's concentrated in these areas. And you can sort of see the topography. This is actually zoomed in from this map, and it's the same neighborhoods in both of those circumstances. These next maps show the same neighborhoods, but in terms of median household income, eighth grade reading achievement, and asthma. Again, not evenly distributed across the community, concentrated in just a handful of neighborhoods. And so Benny also talked about this, and so did Michael. So look at this graph on the right. This is one of the most astounding things to think about, right? So minimum wage in the state of Tennessee is $15,000. So for somebody that's making $15,000 a year, this is 100% of their income. So between just housing, transportation, and food, that's it. that's more than 100% of their income. So it's like, there's no getting out of that. You can't save your way out of that situation. It is literally too expensive to be poor in these neighborhoods. And as Benny said, all of these expenditures, rent, transportation, utilities, and food, are all leaving the neighborhood. None of those things are going into things that are owned by people in the neighborhood. Rent is going to landlords that live out of town and often out of state. Transportation is going to buy here, pay here car lots. Utilities are going to the local utility and then going into the ground in the form of coal, natural gas, and other non-renewable resources. Food is all chain restaurants and corner stores. All of that money leaves the neighborhood instantly. So none of this is by accident in a place like Chattanooga. So this is the redlining map of Chattanooga from 1939, outlining the same neighborhoods, but in this case, explicitly along racial lines. So saying, we are not going to invest, and we're not going to allow the people that live in this neighborhood to invest in the quality of their housing. And that was strategic, that was intentional, and we're still living with the effects of that. It didn't go away. From 2009 to 2014, First Tennessee Bank, which is the largest originator of mortgages in the state of Tennessee, issued one mortgage to an African-American family. One. So what are we doing about this? So again, like Benny said, we're going to reiterate this. It's change moves at the speed of trust. And Benny, full credit to Nathaniel Smith, there, Partnership for Southern Equity, your neighbor. And, you know, we started with focus groups and just went and listened and just sat down and said, what is your experience? What are the challenges? What do you love? What do you, you know, absolutely, like, why do you stay in this neighborhood? What is it you love about it? You know, there's not a wall around it. Like, what keeps you here? And so we then followed up with these in community advisory and action groups that directed what we would do in those neighborhoods. So we didn't go in and make the decision. We just followed where people told us to go. That's really important. So the next thing is we started these basic energy workshops. We taught low cost and no cost. We still teach low cost and no cost ways for people to lower their electric bills. We've had over 3,000 residents attend these. And the average savings of people that just come to a workshop, that's all that happens, is 5%, but we have instances of up to 40% of people just taking that information, going home, making changes. Then building on top of that, again, like Benny talked about, like, let's talk about workforce development. Okay, so we're currently in our seventh class of a workforce development program as part of the AmeriCorps Opportunity Youth Service Initiative. We're hoping for this to be part of the Civilian Climate Corps. So if anybody's involved in those discussions, hit me up when we're done with this. But so our graduates get OSHA 10 certified. We do lead abatement certification and other certifications for weatherization. We've got a 90% graduation and job placement rate. This last class had 100% job placement rate, 60% graduation rate. Then the last thing I'm going to talk about, which I think is really important, is this ability to look for these other benefits. So we found that there were substantial health benefits in the projects that we were doing in improving people's homes. And we said, okay, there's value there to somebody. And so we're currently negotiating with TennCare, which is our Medicaid organization in the state of Tennessee, to come up with a program to basically be able to be reimbursed for improvements to people's homes that improve asthma outcomes. So if we can go in and do mold remediation, air sealing, you know, clean the indoor air and keep the outside air out, we can reduce these kids' emergency room visits and hospitalizations. And if we can just share the savings with the healthcare provider, we can pay for those home improvements. And that's whether they own their home or are a renter, it doesn't matter. We can do it either way, as long as we can pay for it through this sort of back end impact investment model. That's all I got.
All right. Thank you very much. That was good information. All right. So, Abu, do you have anything to add to this? Lou Nguyen?
Hi, Sierra. Thanks for the shout out on that. No, I absolutely love what Betty, Michael, and Michael just shared there with us. I think the green spaces there is a great implementation or even an example of how like a CCL type of bill, HR 763, you know, with the carbon dividend pricing model actually can benefit, turn around and benefit the community and really address the equity standpoints there, right? So I put out there on the chat space there just a little bit of background on 763 with CCL. But I think that the piece to take away from that is that there is this benefit that flows back out to the community, right? And that empowers them, enables them to do something. And I like what Green Spaces did with, which is providing the energy savings kits, right? Which is giving me some ideas as I work with corporates who are always wanting to make a greater impact from a sustainability standpoint. And I think that impact is the authenticity aspect that Benny hit on, right? And how you can do that is perhaps take some of that savings there, redirect those funds, right? That would otherwise just go to your bottom line or shareholders. And I just thought of the term economic additionality, right? So we hear about renewables and additionality in renewables and having that impact, but what about economic additionality and taking that and making that an opportunity and a resource for the community, the equity, specifically the low income segments. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other comments here?
Hey, Michael, Michael Fladmark here. And so I have a question regarding your outreach program and training in regards to these weatherization kits. And so do you train, I know you're getting them in jobs in the solar side of things, but what about being able to have them go within the community and work on weatherization programs? Have you?
That's what we do. That's what we do. So this last class,
okay. Weatherized 15 minutes. Okay. Mm-hmm. So,
Actually the core. That is the primary focus. And then we have had graduates that have gone on to do solar installation and other things. Yeah.
So what's the economic model there for those people as far as being able to get compensated for their time and initiative going in?
We pay them.
You pay them directly. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that's good. Now I will say, so we are fighting for a $15 minimum wage for the Civilian Climate Corps. We think that's a really important component of that. So right now the AmeriCorps stipend is capped at effectively $8 an hour. They don't say it like that, but that's the result. Mm-hmm. And so that really limits our ability to recruit people, but those people that we do recruit are coming out with jobs that are paying, you know, between $15 and $20 an hour. So right now, in lieu of the Civilian Climate Corps, we're talking about partnering with some local developers that could help close the pay gap for us so they can pay them separately on their own payroll while they're learning the skills that we're teaching for home performance. But the most important thing, and Benny sort of hit on this, is the stability of their basic lives as they come into this program. The gap between where unemployed, at-risk young adults are in our community that have been tied up in the criminal justice system and where an employer expects people to be able to keep their regular job, a lot of things live in that gap, like housing, transportation, health, you know, food security, things like that. And so we really focus on closing those gaps and improving overall stability to get people to the point where like Benny said, like once they're in that role, once they have those things that they need, they're the best employees.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any other comments, anybody? Questions, Chris, Kara?
Yeah, so the challenge always is that you want to get members of the low-income community be able to start saving money, right? Mm-hmm. So how do you get them there?
Right.
Because otherwise they're not building any wealth. And so the next step is also, how do you get them to be owners of property?
Mm-hmm.
That's the other challenge, because almost everyone in the LMI community is renting.
Yeah, so you know, there's not an easy answer to that question. So there's not a silver bullet, but I would say there's silver buckshot. So if you can do a number of things at the same time, I think you can get to that point, Michael. But it's important to note that home ownership is not always right for everybody. That's not always the right end goal. Sometimes you want to have more flexibility and, you know, be able to move to another city or move to another part of town for a job, you know, especially if you don't have good public transportation like we do. So what I would like to see is more community ownership models over the rental housing, right? So community land trusts, cooperative ownership structures, limited equity co-ops that can provide that sort of initial housing, and then also having strategically located workforce housing that is specifically for workforce development to get people on their feet,
mm-hmm.
And then get them to a place where they can have enough money to save and then be able to get into home ownership if that's the right thing for them. But in any case, you're absolutely right that like building wealth is mm-hmm. the key, and closing yeah. the racial wealth gap is the key.
Right. And I think some of that is related to, you know, consideration of, say, providing financial literacy training. I really, really do. Because one thing I have learned is that there is assets or resources in communities, you know, that we define as low income, whether they be rural or urban. But because of the fact there has not been maybe any money management training or financial literacy training, you know, there is no consideration of perhaps of pooling money, you know, through faith-based organizations, things like that. So I think financial literacy is something that I would consider as a value add, you know, when we do these type of projects. And because again, there's money in the community, but it doesn't necessarily stay in the community. And I think maybe financial literacy could at least capture some of those financial resources so they can be used to support, you know, business in the community and to start saving.
So Benny, what you said earlier in your remarks about like slowing that velocity of money so that you're mm-hmm. recycling it, I think mm-hmm. that is exactly what we have to focus on. So mm-hmm. building, you know, right now what we see are siphons, right?
Right.
Everything is extracting like right. wealth from these communities. And so anything that you can do
mm-hmm.
to keep money in the community.
Yeah.
And so those dollars that are being spent are going to people in the community.
Mm-hmm.
That's what lifts the community up from the inside out, rather mm-hmm. than coming in with a bunch of money.
Right.
Like, you know, redeveloping the neighborhood and then displacing
right.
all those people that live there.
Right. Exactly.
Like, that's what leads to gentrification and displacement is mm-hmm. that like outside force coming in.
Yeah.
We've got to build this infrastructure from the inside out. And that's what our Build a Green program is all about.
Yeah, good stuff.
If I might, Munir Azay, I'm on a workplace that we're required to wear masks still. So hopefully folks can hear me. I wanted to mention that there are some really unique companies and organizations that are developing some community ownership models, particularly where you can create a community, you know, owning a community solar plant where it can be crowdfunded, for example, very small starting investments. It does get community members vested, and it provides a good return. You know, you have to structure it around a PPA with the local utility, for example.
Doesn't work in Texas.
Which would not work in Texas.
Well, yeah, it works in our munis and it works in our co-ops, but in the deregulated market, That's what our challenge is.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I imagine, you know, it is getting traction in New England where I'm based. I think in California, but I'd be curious about your view. You know, I'm sure you're familiar with some of these models, but.
Yeah, we similarly can't do that because we're in TVA's service territory, and TVA is a federal utility, and we can't even do PPAs.
Well, you raise an interesting point because with the new Green Deal going out and the energy focus and work programs and everything like that, do you think that view may change?
I hope so. I mean, there's four new appointees to the board that haven't made it to the board yet. Mm-hmm. They have to be approved. Well, it's a presidential appointment, so they should all make it. And they're all absolutely stellar, you know, advocates for renewable energy. Hopefully that'll change soon. Now, so I should say TVA is in a good place when it comes to decarbonization. They're just behind the curve on solar specifically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was my experience, Michael, because I had two project teams in Memphis.
Yeah.
The Solar Community Challenge. And, you know, I know that your local utility, which municipally owned, is owned by the city. I know they have new leadership there. But, I do think the relationship with TVA was somewhat of a barrier.
Yeah.
Or, you know, in Memphis and whatnot.
Yeah, all of this is like changing as we speak. There's these new contracts that TVA made with local power companies that has given them up to 5% flexibility in their like purchasing. So before they have to buy 100% of their energy from TVA.
Okay.
Contractually. Mm-hmm. So that's why the like PPAs you can't do because they can't be sold. So now the local power companies have this 5% that they're able to work with. Mm-hmm. None of them know what to do with it yet. This is so new that they're still trying to figure out what that looks like. We have a couple community solar arrays in Chattanooga. Mm-hmm. I guess one community solar array and then one that's city owned. The ability to really drive that ourselves, like that had to be driven by EPB. So our local power company, they had to do it. Mm-hmm. So it's evolving.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's good. That's a good start though. That's good to hear.
All right, David Kay, you have a question?
Sure, I'm speaking in part, perhaps with apologies as mostly as an academic. At Cornell University in New York. I'm not far from where Chris Carrick sits, but I want to, but I work a lot in both, sort of community development, housing, energy topics, and I work a lot with people in communities. So I kind of want to pick, I want to make one observation and then pick up on the question, which a broader version of the question that I think Munir put in the chat, which is, so the question first is like, what insights do y'all have on how the kind of work that you're doing, which seems from what I heard, very place-based and building on, the idea that change moves at the speed of trust, relational, that's a relational kind of thing. So what do you offer as organizations and or just as you're not from your knowledge about how these kinds of models can sort of seed each other or support each other or move from the places where they're already deeply rooted into other communities. And then just as one example, just like we had a little bit of discussion about I think it was, I'm sorry, I even forgot your name, Mr. Greenspace.
Michael.
About community land trusts and so on. So just to kind of show about the sort of the situational context and how much they differ, like we have a community land trust model for what we call our neighborhood housing services organization. And they started out, in a, I would say, a not super hot real estate market locally, but, you know, moderate one. And they had a model essentially where all of the appreciated value of property went to the homeowner or the person that they helped acquire the home. And within about 10 years, when we turned into a hot market, they were essentially going to go out of business because they were unable to continue doing that model because they were losing essentially the sort of as a proportion of what housing costs. They had no equity to work with at that point. So they had to redo the model in the context of a very specific market where they went to a more shared model of appreciated value of housing. But that I only say that as an example of how, you know, for a few years, one model worked and then they had to change it in the context they were in.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that. And that goes back to that thing I said, like there's not one right answer. And like the answer changes, you know, constantly. And there's multiple answers. So that's a great point. Currently, so let me answer the first part of your question first. So one of the keys for us has been the Department of Energy's Better Buildings Residential Network, which is a really great like asset and resource sharing place for these kinds of programs. The actual model for Empower, after we did those focus groups and built those community advisory and action groups, we actually borrowed a program from Durham, North Carolina called Pete Street that was in this Better Buildings Residential Network. So we didn't recreate the wheel. You know, we took that material. It's on Creative Commons, so it's like you can rebrand it. But that was sort of the framework, and we adapted it some. But that was what we used for this sort of like really basic, sort of neighbor to neighbor training, these really basic workshops. So I think it's absolutely replicable, and we're happy to work with anybody, you know, that wants to do some of the things that we're doing. You know, what we're doing with the Civilian Climate Corps is sort of along those lines. So we're working with the Corps network nationally to help advocate for other corps to do the kind of work that we're doing. So then the second part of the question about the sort of different ownership models, I think it's an all of the above approach. You know, it's not just community land trusts. It's community land trusts, you know, plus cooperatives, plus community development corporations, you know, plus just good neighborhood organizing. You know, it's all of those things together that can lead to a really strong neighborhood that can build wealth for people that have been traditionally left out. Benny, what would you add to that though?
Yeah, I'm thinking along those lines, and I'm involved with this HBCU Clean Energy Initiative. And it went from, you know, my thinking went from, you know, putting panels on roofs to transitioning towards manufacturing. Because as you guys probably know, you know, the U.S., we spend like $19 billion on panels annually, estimated on panels imported from overseas. So we're looking at manufacturing so that these jobs, the people employed at these manufacturing facilities are people who actually live in the community, right? The other thought is as it relates to research with HBCUs, we're pushing their research and development to think about solar devices that don't necessarily involve putting a roof, rather a panel on a roof. You know, maybe this more portability involved so that if someone is renting, it's just about providing a device for them to have power in the event of a power outage, or if they want power to power their TV, or if it's just to power their, as I said before, electric home equipment. So we have to think just really broadly. It's not a one size fit all approach, but I think with this push now that we are as a country focused on, you know, buying American-made products, you know, we can get to these circular economies in low-income communities, and that's what we need. And as I said before, it's not just urban, it's also these same concerns in rural communities. You know, I had a meeting with a mayor of a small rural town near Atlanta, and he said the thing that keeps him up at night is the cyber attack. and you know, how that would cut off, you know, their water supply. And he was interested in how solar plus storage could be, you know, a backup for him. And he has the same challenge, you know, manufacturing has left his community. So I think, you know, we're heading in the right direction when we think about manufacturing and that we're being able to control our supply chain, because I think what COVID exposed is that, you know, we can't be a country where everything is made overseas, right? And going back to corporate America, it really is, you know, not trying to steal a tagline, but it really is a me too type of mindset. You know, someone sees something that someone else does, then they all follow in lockstep. So my goal is to focus on the corporations that are willing to come out here and support what we're trying to do, because the smart corporations will focus. This is a great opportunity for them to create competitive advantage, you know, in this space. And so that's what I see us heading towards. But I do, as I said before, I'm optimistic, you know, now that we have administration in place, you know, that are equally interested in solving some of these same problems.
Andy McDowell, you have a comment there? Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah. Hi, I wanted to ask Michael and Benny if you've had any experience with on-bill financing programs for financing energy efficiency improvements.
I have not.
Yeah, I have some thoughts on that. I haven't personally like run one, but before I got to Chattanooga, they had an on-bill finance program that had like 7% interest rates that failed miserably and left a bad taste in our local power company, EPB's mouth. And so when I started to bring that stuff up, they sort of put cold water on it. But I think we found more opportunity in on meter tariffs. So the pay as you save model, I think, is one that's a little bit better, where instead of just straight on bill finance that's tied to an individual, the financing is tied to the electric meter. Mm-hmm. And so whoever is paying the electric bill is paying back the investment for the high efficiency heat pump. I think that's a really scalable model. It's worked really well. It's in like 62 utilities around the country. It's been approved by TVA for our footprint. And so we hope that that's right around the corner. I know that EPB is looking at it. So yeah, that's what I think about that.
Craig Lewis?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Craig. You have to unmute your...
Yep. Hello, everybody. I came to the call late, so my apologies if this is a little bit redundant, but I think one of the, you know, big opportunities for every community is resilience, and especially renewables-driven resilience gets us that trifecta of the economics that Benny's kind of talking about, getting that energy activity happening locally, including all the way down to the site of a university. So we got the economic, the trifecta, you know, the kind of the magic trifecta is economics, environment, and resilience. And at least in the time I've been on the call, I haven't heard a whole lot about the resilience side of it, but, this is where I would encourage even the universities, Benny, to make sure that you are doing a solar microgrid there. I put a link in the thread, back at 9:41 that has a link to solar microgrids that the Clean Coalition facilitated for the Santa Barbara Unified School District, which includes some really major high schools. These are, you know, 2000 plus student high schools. They're like mini colleges, right? And so you just scale it up for a college footprint. And these are money savers. So you got the economics. They are environmentally beneficial, obviously. You know, you got solar instead of buying grid power. They're resilient. You can island from the grid and keep your critical loads on forever, and all the rest of your loads on for the majority of time as well. So I guess that's the background for, you know, is there focus on resilience, and is that a way to really entice in some of the municipalities we need to be dealing with, and also some of the communities where that's like, okay, you're not getting ownership here, but you are getting resilience that you've never had before. And of course you're getting these environmental benefits, which, you know, historically you've been crapped on, and now all of a sudden we're going to, you're going to have the cleanest energy, you know, in the area.
Yeah. So we have been working on that. The city of Chattanooga has done a really good job of investing in resilience. They just finished a 5-megawatt solar array at our wastewater treatment plant. Our airport has the ability to be completely off grid with its own microgrid that can, it's got 3 megawatts of solar. And then they're currently building a microgrid out at our like 911 call center with the police headquarters. So those things are definitely starting and moving. They're not really focused yet on low-income neighborhoods from a resilient standpoint. We do have we have been using our community solar project, which is like 2 megawatts, to offset bills for Habitat for Humanity, their new homes, where we've got a package where they can get basically some of the panels in the community solar array that offset the bill for the Habitat house. So we're like nibbling around the edge of that.
Muneer, you have a comment or question?
Can I just follow up on that for a second? And one is that in addition to the municipalities, I think that especially when we're dealing with lower income communities, we're almost inevitably always dealing with multi-unit housing. And the Clean Coalition's working on essentially a solar microgrid that can be turned into a community microgrid for an entire low income housing complex in the middle of San Francisco. And I'm going to drop it into the, I'm going to drop a link to the 2-page yeah. overview of that project into the chat here in a second. But, you know, I think, you know, thinking about low income and senior living facilities, which, you know, largely are multi-unit housing, those are really tremendous opportunities to essentially provide resilience to a, you know, clean, renewables driven resilience to what should be and arguably are critical community facilities. Because if you don't have those people sheltering in place, you're using really precious first responder resources to schlep those people to an emergency shelter, which is then taking up beds at your emergency shelter, right? When you had a really easy opportunity to shelter these people in place.
Yeah, unfortunately, actually, that's not the case in Chattanooga. Most of our affordable housing is single family built before 1940. So we actually have very little affordable multifamily. There, we have some, but compared to like a big city, you're absolutely right. Like every big city, you know, that's exactly in line with what we've seen. And that makes it easier, to be honest, to do these kinds of like, you know, complex sort of solar and PPA projects when you're dealing with a multifamily building owner, because they're very sophisticated. They want the tax breaks. They want the, like, you know, the incentives that you can provide them. When you're dealing with 10,000 single family homes under, you know, 1200 square feet, the problem's a little bit harder to wrap your hands around.
Okay, Manur, you have...
Yeah, a question for the panelists. I've been dealing with in particular one town, but I know there are multiple. And this is a well-to-do town that's developing their climate action plan. And interestingly enough, I mean, they highlight climate justice as an objective of the plan. And the question came up, well, but we don't have a lot of low income, you know, situations in the town. So why would it affect us? In you know, why would we put that as a priority in our climate action plan? I think that even the well-to-do town should be integrating climate justice and doing things to support that. And I'd be curious as to some of the panelists' thoughts about what they can be doing in their own climate action plans to help the broader community.
Well, I know here in Dallas, we're actually, the city of Dallas is focusing on developing the resiliency hubs now. And so part of that focus is gonna be in the low income communities, because, you know, we just experienced a full week of no power in North Texas. The problem that the city of Dallas has is because it's not a muni. It buys its power through a third party from a third, you know, someone else who's generating the power. And so, you know, they're very challenged at how to do that. So it's a great model that works in LA, you know, because you have your own, you know, opportunity to take advantage of the municipality there that manages everything. And then the funding under that, I mean, those are large programs. And so how does that funding get deferred? And so I like the concept that Craig brought up as far as it goes to the meter owner, right? It's for multifamily housing, and then it gets dispersed from there. But it's a challenge. There's no doubt about it.
Hey, we're almost out of time here, so go ahead.
I would just quickly jump in response. So I work mostly on land use implications of siting and siting issues around renewables and rural urban relationships. So I just put in the context of climate justice and energy justice and all that, like, you know, where facilities go, this, you know, given that there probably is not self-sufficiency capacity within urban areas to supply all of their electricity needs in most places locally, you know, thinking about where they go, who benefits, regionalizing decision-making essentially with a climate and energy justice lens, I think is like really critical. So, you know, I work mostly at the community level, but that's not enough.
So we have a pretty successful program in Houston that's been developed called the Sunnyside Community Solar Program. And Houston is not a municipal, it's open, it's deregulated and everything. And we're hoping to take that model, that successful model, where they're building on a landfill, they're repurposing a landfill that's been abandoned and everything. And they're moving that forward, but they're carving out a small portion of that for low-income community as a PPA. So we're hoping that model works and we can transfer that up to other areas of the state as well. So there are opportunities. Co-ops in Texas, there's actually been a couple of successful programs developed, just developing 10 acres for 1 megawatt of power that then, you know, they're in the nearby community that our co-ops, you know, they all are part owners of the co-op, and then they can share and buy, you know, interest into those and get renewable energy that way. So.
Hey, we got about 1 minute left. Anybody else quickly? Okay. All right. Thanks to our panel. Again, interesting, very important discussion. And next Thursday, we're going to have a discussion on microgrids, again, what's going on in the microgrid area. Craig will be on that panel for sure. And then also on Friday, May 7th, we have a new approach to CCAs, which Lynn Arthur from Peak Power in Long Island is going to be discussing a different way of approaching the CCAs that they have started over in that area. And also following up, I'm sure, on other discussions on PPAs. I've been trying to corral Samuel Golding into doing a call again, but he has been overwhelmed right now up in New Hampshire on trying to get CCA's policy changed in New Hampshire, and he's making headway on that. So when we do get him on a call, he's going to be a really interesting person to hear what's been going on with the last 6 months. So anyhow, thanks so much for everybody for coming, and I hope to see you all next week.
Can I put in a quick plug for the North Texas Renewable Energy Group? Our speaker in June, I believe, is going to be Emery Levins from NREL.
Okay, cool.
So that'll be, he's amazing. So if you have the opportunity, please join us. The link was part of my resources. So that's the North Texas Renewable Energy Group.
Appreciate it. Yeah, that sounds good. Excellent.
Thanks, Sierra. Thanks, everyone.
Yeah.
All right, thank everybody. Good discussion.
Thank you, Sierra.
Thank you all for coming.